thank you for joining us at Execution Watch. Tonight, we witness the execution of Frank Moore. You'll have Ray Hill host, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Dave Atwood, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty's Vigil, and you'll have Professor Dennis Longmire, our live reporter in Huntsville, outside the Death House. And tonight, special guest Scott Cobb, president of the Texas Moratorium Network. Join us as we witness the execution of Frank Moore and discuss the issues surrounding his execution and execution in general. Join us as we discuss why Texas spends millions of dollars each year executing enough people to make us the death penalty capital of the Western world. Stay tuned.
And I am Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. You're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel, and you're listening on the internet at executionwatch.org and I'll link on kpft.org as well as theprisonshow.org. Tonight there's an execution in process, and Dennis Longmire is in Huntsville. Dennis.
Yes, I'm not able to hear you very clearly.
Well, I'll try to speak it up.
Okay.
Does that help?
The transmission breaks up very much, so pardon me if I speak over you. I'll let you know the witnesses have all gone into the building. There are about 15 people here on the corner. Several people who are very, very close to Frank. One person is willing to speak with, if you guys would like.
Yes, please. Okay, please, Dennis.
Second. Let me put her on. You will identify yourself.
My name is Zenobia. I am Frank Moore's mother.
Okay.
We adopted each other some 16 years ago.
And how long, what has this ordeal been like for you?
It's justice in the extreme form. Self-defense should never, ever be a capital offense. Ever. And the state of Texas is just performing a triage on men. May God have mercy. May the Akashic Record view that the people responsible for this murder also suffer the same consequences.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was pretty strong, Dennis. Thank you for putting Frank's mother on.
Okay. Also, Bonnie is going to speak. One second.
Okay.
A friend of Frank.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Caraway. I'm a good friend of his mom's, and I've been visiting for about, I guess, close to 6 or 7 years, and this is definitely a case of self-defense, right? Fired in self-defense. Two guys were running him down in the car out in front of a bar. He didn't even have a gun on him, and they were trying to run over him, and they were shooting at him, and someone threw him a gun, and he returned fire, and he killed him. But it's too late to do anything about that now. Okay, I'm going to let his mom tell you about witnesses.
Of the 200 people in that club that night, we have witnesses who've given us sworn testimony to say that Frank Moore simply and defended himself and nothing more. And this is a gross miscarriage of justice. They will never, the police never interviewed them. The people that he had this aggression with had even gone so far as to hold up and rob a 70-year-old man 2 hours before. They also shot at him. They've also killed people. They had enough drugs in them that nobody knows how they were standing. And Cookin was 15 years old on a Thursday night in a bar, drunk as a skunk. Now, Frank was simply defending because another young man put out a cigarette in a woman's face. This is how the whole thing started. So, thank you.
Okay.
Dennis, keep us posted of what happens there.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Keep us posted about what happens there.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire, Professor of Criminal Justice at Sam Houston State University. And I am back in the studio with Jim Skelton. Jim?
Yes.
You've looked at this case pretty thoroughly?
Yes.
What's the story?
Well, there's two versions to what happened. You've heard the mother's version, and then the other version comes from what the state had to say. From the state's version, what happened is based primarily on the testimony of one particular witness. There was a lady by the name of Angela Wallace. And Angela Wallace was visiting San Antonio, and she didn't know anybody involved in this at all. And she was dating, or had a girlfriend who was dating a guy by the name of Clark. She's dating a guy named Samuel Boyd. So she goes to the club, and while she's at the club, she sees Frank Moore, and she sees her girlfriend's boyfriend, who's Clark, Samuel Boyd. And Samuel Boyd he's a 23-year-old man, and with him was a 15-year-old kid, and his name is Patrick Clark. And she saw Frank Moore talking to both of these two young men throughout the evening. She said there were no problems, everybody seemed to be getting along. She claimed everybody was doing fine. Then what she says happens, just before the club closes at 2 o'clock, she apparently had been flirting some with Frank Moore. So Frank Moore comes over to her and asked her to save the last dance for him and wanted her phone number. She wouldn't give him her phone number, but he gave her his phone number. And they talked, and then as they were talking, a man who was later identified as Ivory Sheffield comes up to Frank Moore, whispers something to him. Now, this is what Angela Wallace claims happened. Wallace claims after Sheffield comes up and whispers to Frank Moore, they go outside. And then she leaves the club. She says outside the club there's a confrontation between Frank Moore, one of his friends, his half-brother, and Sheffield. And then this kid Clark, this young guy named Boyd, and another man. They get into an argument. And she doesn't say what the argument's about. And she says everybody disperses. At that point, she claims that the two guys, Boyd and Clark, run and get in a car to leave. And she claims at this point is when this guy Sheffield pitches an M16 rifle over to Frank Moore, and Moore puts six and ten bullets inside the car. Shoots and kills both guys. Kills one, shoots him six times, and shoots one five times. She sees no weapons, sees no guns, sees no anything. Now, that's the state's version of the fact coming from a witness named Angela
Wallace.
M16? Well, he shot one guy six times and one five times. Oh, it was M1, I'm sorry, wasn't it?
M1.
So what happens after the killing occurred, then he pitches the gun back to Ivory Sheffield, and they drive off. That's the state's version of the facts. Now, what happened at the first trial, Moore's half-brother testifies. And here's what he claimed happened. It's not quite like what the mother said occurred. Frank Moore's half-brother, Tyrone, claims that earlier during the evening, he saw the two boys, Boyd and Clark, outside in the parking lot. He claimed there were argument with a woman. He claimed that Boyd put out a cigarette in the woman's face. At this time, Frank Moore was nowhere around. He was outside the club in the parking lot. He claims they go back inside the club, and he thinks the two young men who were killed, Boyd and Clark, are real drunk, knocking things over, acting like fools. And he claims that they're asked to leave the club. He claims at that point these two guys leave the club, and that he and his brother in Sheffield go outside. There's a confrontation in the parking lot because they're mad about what had happened earlier about putting out the cigarette in the girl's mouth. He claims that at this point that Clark and Moore get in the car and try to run over Clark. And that he's absolutely nothing the first
Clark and Boyd.
About shooting, nothing at all. He just claimed they tried to run over him in the car. When he tried to run over him in the car, they should shake Frank Moore shot in self-defense when he's trying to get run over by the car. And the shooting, the claim about them doing the shooting didn't come up until several years later. But the initial witness, who was his half-brother, claims to have seen nothing about anybody shooting. He just simply claims the two guys in the car tried to run over Frank Moore and him.
Okay, now this is at the Wheels of Joy Club, which sounds to me like a motorcycle or raising...
I think it might have been a gangbanger thing, because throughout all of this case and everything I read, all these people apparently were at least accused of being in gangs and involved in gangs. As a matter of fact, what I found to be quite interesting, according, this comes from the blog written by Frank Moore himself. He claims that he assumed a name by the name of Frank Mackey. He was a man his mother had taken up with. And he claimed that when his mother took up with Frank Mackey, and here's what he basically said, he gave me game how to survive. This is words out of Frank Moore's mouth.
Sure.
He said, he said that Mackey told him, you've got to be a strong individual. If you ain't driven by the best of what you're doing, you're weak. You get ate by the bigger fish. You've got to be a shark. And he, in fact, he adopted his name, and was a gangbanger when he was a young kid. He was involved in a lot of the gangs around San Antonio.
The ages here strike me as being significant. You've got Frank Moore in 34 at the time of the crime, and then you've got the two people that were killed. One was 23, and the other was 15. And that's and in a club, and everybody drunk and stoned on something.
Well, the evidence in the medical examiner doesn't indicate, the only thing they indicate but with drugs, that Clark might have had some muscle relaxants. They were drunk. It's primarily alcohol.
And one of them, I'm thinking the older one was seriously drunk.
Both of them were seriously drunk.
Over 0.2, and the one was 1.8 or something.
Muscle relaxants were the only drugs they talked about. So it wasn't any methamphetamine, things like that, to indicate that.
Well, what happened to court?
Well, what happened in court, they had those two versions of what happened, and then they have an issue of self-defense, and they ruled against self-defense, mainly because they didn't find any weapons at the scene. And so they ruled against him on self-defense and convicted him for murder first time around. Then on the first appeal, the Court of Criminal Appeals reversed it. And the reason they reversed it is pretty simple. Back then, you had a deal called voluntary manslaughter. And what, man, if you kill somebody after you've been provoked, it's kind of like someone killing in the heat of passion. If somebody does something that would normally enrage a person and they kill somebody, that would reduce the charge down to voluntary manslaughter. In this particular case, there was testimony, there had been an argument. There was testimony these two guys tried to run over him, which would provoke most people, and that he killed during that rage, that provocation. So that submitted the issue. They should have submitted a lesser-included offense of voluntary manslaughter.
And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals found this in the record.
Right. And then the second thing they reversed it on, it's real interesting. In order for this to be a captive murder case, the state alleged that he committed two murders in one criminal transaction. Well, what's interesting, he claimed he shot in self-defense. So if he claimed he shot at Clark in self-defense, this would make the murder justifiable. If the murder's justifiable, there wouldn't be multiple murders during the same transaction, because one is justifiable, if you believe the self-defense story.
Yeah, one would be justifiable. Therefore, this would be something less than a capital case.
Right. So what they should have done, the jury should have given the jury the option of convicting him of voluntary manslaughter or regular murder as opposed to capital murder. And since they didn't give the jury the option of selecting those two lesser offenses, because one of them, they said, well, he was acting under sudden passion because of the argument and fight. That's where the killing resulted from. They should have submitted that issue to the
jury.
And
this is a Bexar County case?
Yeah, I heard of San Antonio, yes. So they reversed the case based on that. They go back to trial, and when they go back to trial, they have a different set of witnesses. State doesn't, defense has a different set of witnesses. Now, at the second trial, one of the witnesses claimed that the men inside the car shot first. And they're claiming that this is where the shooting evidence first came out. So in the second trial, the jury heard, number one, witnesses for Frank Moore testify that two men in the car tried to run him down in the parking lot and tried to kill him. They also heard from witnesses for Frank Moore that the men inside the car shot first, and that Frank Moore only shot in response to them shooting at him. But the jury obviously didn't believe it, and they rejected self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second trial is where they introduced all the evidence about gang membership, introduced some prior convictions. He had been convicted before for attempting to kill another gangbanger. Had been convicted for some drug offenses, had been a member of the Crips when he was 14 years of age, had been a member of another gang, was sergeant-at-arms for the Black Panthers, got in some trouble when he was in jail, and quite a bit of stuff that went on as far as his criminal record. And primarily, they got the impression they were convicting him for being a member of a gang because he'd been a drug dealer. And apparently had that sort of history from being on the streets. And that was the evidence that came in at punishment.
And this execution is scheduled on the exact 15th anniversary of the original crime.
That I didn't notice.
Yeah, it's January 21st.
And then what happened, Ray, after he was convicted the second time and given the death penalty the second time, the jury rejected self-defense the second time. What happened, real interesting, and how this really came about is never really explained, the stuff I can find, but there was an investigator that comes along, and he had been, apparently, had a security company that had been working, had the job to have security on some of the public and housing projects, and apparently knew Frank Moore. And this investigator starts digging into this place, and he claims that he had evidence and affidavits from various witnesses who were afraid to come forward that claimed the two men who were killed, in fact, tried to kill Frank Moore earlier that month in some sort of gang thing. They were mad at him, wanting to get rid of him. And they claimed they even shot at him earlier, a couple of days prior to this particular shooting. This is contrary to what the witnesses for the state testified in both trials.
Because yeah, said they were all chummy.
They were all chummy. They were all shaking hands and big friends at the nightclub, apparently. But they claimed that these two guys who were doing the killing had tried to kill Frank Moore earlier and had shot at him. And they claimed they were bragging they were going to get him and take him out. And this is what they, and then what they did, the same investigator who did the investigation claims that he had evidence that the people inside the car were shooting at Frank Moore first, and there were bullet holes in the building behind Frank Moore to show this, and he claims that he had affidavits from other witnesses that claimed that the family of the two dead boys took the guns away before the police arrived. And he also claimed, the investigator, that he told the police this information. The police told him to pretty well mind his own business, that this guy was a drug dealer and he was going to need to go to jail. And that all that came up in subsequent writ hearings. But the federal courts pretty well flushed it because, number one, it's what you call hearsay within hearsay. This was the investigator claiming that people that worked for him were told by other people that these facts occurred. And the problem is when you come in on a writ after you had a trial, you got to be able to demonstrate the new evidence you got was something that you should have, that you couldn't have gotten at the time of trial by due diligence, and they knew about this all along if it was in fact true. Because this guy was no particular secret, the investigator wasn't.
15 years from the time of the crime to the time of the execution, it took a couple of years to try the case, I'm sure. Got a reversal in 97. The crime happened in 94, January 21st, 1994. And then it got a reversal in 97, so it was retried. That's still pretty rapid speed through the courts, considering the hitch and the come along with the reversal.
Yeah, because see, you've got 24 people who ruled against self-defense. It wasn't one of those where one person said it wasn't a self-defense. The first jury rejected self-defense. The second jury rejected self-defense. You had 24 people that... See, one of the problems you got one guy shot six times, one shot five times, and that's kind of overkill.
And for the most part, in the side and the back.
In the back, off in the back. They all shot from behind the car, yeah. They weren't heading toward him when the shooting occurred. They were going the other way. If they were moving at all.
So, pretty... rapid turnaround. Is anything else about this case under the litigation that seemed to be unusual?
No. The thing that you always run across, and you get real suspicious, and yeah, I guess you get kind of skeptical, because when I was tracking down the affidavit that the investigator did on the writ, that was all real vague, because what he basically said, the information about these two dead guys being involved in gangs, and these two dead guys, and I'm sure they were involved in a lot of criminal stuff, and investigating their claim that they had murdered other people, primarily came from unnamed people who told unnamed sources who then told the investigator. And you know as well as I do that courts will not pay much attention to that because they call it hearsay within hearsay. And the reason they say that these people gave the investigator this information were afraid to give their names. They were fearful of retaliation. Well, the guys they were talking about are both dead. I mean, they come up out of the grave and choke their necks or anything. But that makes one very skeptical.
Yeah, but the, if there is an element of gangs here, you know, and here he is hanging out the same place they're hanging out. So if he was a gangbanger, chances are that they were close to gangbangers. So there is a property opportunity for some kind of retribution. But I was fascinated by something you said earlier about if there are multiple homicides, right, and one of them is shown to be justifiable, then the multiplicity itself does not give rise to a capital case.
Right. Because murder is killing somebody without any excuse. And self-defense excuses murder. And self-defense is not a murder case. So basically what it amounted to, he claimed that in the second trial, remember, there was testimony that Clark shot at him first. So he shoots back, which means if they believe that story of self-defense,
if
and the killing
any
of
the
Clark,
24 jurors,
that's right, if they believe it was self-defense, they're to acquit him of that particular murder. It's a justifiable homicide. It's not considered murder. Therefore, you don't have two murders in one criminal transaction because one of them is justifiable.
And so it falls back down to regular, right, a regular life sentence possibility.
We have that horrible phrase, and I wish we wouldn't use it. We talk about just falling down to regular murder. Well, regular murder sounds like something at Kroger's, you know, at a bin that you go out.
It's not on sale, right?
I want regular murder. I don't want the super murder. You know, it just sounds terrible. But what it basically amounts to, and here's the way the law works. Whenever you have a defense to a case, and you may be accused of something less than what you did, then you're entitled to have the jury consider,
sure,
that. And so what they should have considered on the first trial was voluntary manslaughter.
But that wasn't even in the jury charge, in the first trial.
Yeah, it wasn't in the jury charge. And they should have considered straight murder, regular murder, as opposed to capital murder.
That was how is a jury charge determined?
Jury charge is determined by basically what the indictment says and what the evidence comes afterwards. For example, in this case, he was charged with capital murder, multiple murders in one transaction. Well, during the evidence of the case, they proved up the sudden passion, which brings up the issue of voluntary manslaughter.
And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals found that, and they reversed on that principle.
Oh, yeah. They reversed on, and reversed on both points.
If that had not been evidence in the trial, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals would not have anywhere to go with that.
No, nowhere. And see what they've tried to do, and you read this, I probably read this about once a month, where they will argue on appeal that there is insufficient evidence for the jury to reject self-defense. Because self-defense is kind of peculiar. Here's the way self-defense works. As a defense lawyer, it's your job to raise self-defense by some evidence. And you do that either through a defendant testifying or through a statement in which he said, I shot in self-defense. You got to produce somewhere, some evidence to show the guy could self-defense. Once that's proven, the state's got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that self-defense does not exist. Mm-hmm. And they're instructed, the jury's instructed, you're to stand in the shoes of the defendant and view it from his position, from his,
sure,
viewpoint.
As in all culpability.
Right. And so, like I say, you've had basically the major thing throughout this entire trial was self-defense. And you've had 24 people reject it. And the problem, the real problem, is the number of shots fired, and they were shot from the back. They weren't shot. Now, if you were coming towards somebody, like the car is heading toward them, he shoots them, you got a different animal.
Mm-hmm.
He's shooting them from the car behind the car. And it's kind of like I shot him in the back six times in self-defense. It's kind of hard to sell to a jury. I mean, five times shooting six, and you shoot 10 shots and behind somebody in the car, it's kind of hard to claim you're defending yourself. It's a hard argument.
As murder cases go, is this ordinary?
I don't think they'd seek the death penalty today. Because truth of the matter is, and, you know, in a, you, you know, I don't want to be mean about this, but in all likelihood, when two guys died, they probably should have put in civic improvements rather than an obituary column. Because I would imagine the guys.
Yeah, well, I was. You said you know, if you don't have an excuse for killing somebody, it's murder. But if you do have one, and that they were somebody that deserved killing, is not an excuse enough.
And today, I don't think they'll seek the death penalty in this case, because it's obvious that the people involved were involved in, they were also drug dealers themselves, and they were also the part of the same ilk that kind of run around together. And most people wouldn't be that upset about it, at least not in Texas, they wouldn't be. And we just had a case recently out of Dallas County, which is supposed to be so tough, where a guy broke into an apartment and shoots and kills three people. They don't even seek the death penalty. One of them's a pregnant woman. Mm. And shoots and kills her. And they tried it as captive murder with the death penalty waived. And there were three people killed. And that was, they just affirmed that case about a month ago, which was much more egregious than this set of facts.
What about the factor of inebriation? Is that of the victims? Is that something that happened? You know where the buttons are. And so we're going to have Professor Longmire back with us. Try that. Professor Longmire.
Hello.
Can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay, what's going on?
Okay, all of the witnesses have come out of the Walls unit, and so Frank is another one of the victims of the state of criminal justice's machine.
I know you have...
They're leaving right now. They're anxiously going so they can get to the funeral home in hopes of being able to feel him and touch him before he leaves. His mother, the woman who spoke to us, has to go back to San Antonio tonight, so she's going to catch an airplane. So they're all beginning to leave right now.
Okay, now I know you had the mother and her mother's friend. And if you would not have seen the witnesses for the people that were alleged murdered.
No, the witnesses for the victims are already in the prison, and they go into the main unit before 5 o'clock. I don't know what time they arrive, but I always get here about 5, and I have never seen them going in.
Okay, now...
And they started doing that 5 or 6 years ago. I don't know why, but they used to keep everyone over in the main administration building, and there would be 3 waves of witnesses crossing the street. First would be victims. Second would be media. Third would be witnesses for the condemned. Now there are only 2 groups of witnesses that go in. First the media, and then witnesses for the condemned.
Well, witnesses for the condemned, did it include other family members?
Well, yes. It's an interesting... interesting isn't the word. I don't know all of the details of the story, but this is one of those situations where there's a fracture in the family, and so the witnesses that went in to witness are not necessarily on good terms with the family that was out here. So there's some friction I'm not familiar with. As you can imagine, families get torn apart on these
sure.
kind of moments. And
I hope the audience can imagine the stress on a family going
terrible,
through this kind of crisis.
It's a terrible thing to imagine that not only are you struggling with the loss of a loved one, but you've lost family members and their connections as well. So it's a very sad moment in a lot of ways.
Okay, Dennis, thank you very much for your services to the executionwatch.org. And we're going to go and talk to Dave Atwood and wrap that part of the show up for the day.
Okay, give David my regards.
We will, sir.
Okay.
Dennis Longmire, professor of criminal justice, Sam Houston State University, a regular witness at execution occasions in Huntsville. And we're going to try to get Dave on so that we can chat with him. Jim, is there anything we've overlooked in covering this case and the trial of this case that you can think of?
No, when I was reading this, Ray, the thing that bothers me, this just seems to be the end result of people being members of gangs. And if anybody that, you know, it seems like it's inevitable, because here everybody involved is apparently gang members, and that means either you're going to die on the streets at some nightclub, someone's shooting you in the head, or you'll end up on death row. Because it is really, really difficult from a defense viewpoint to defend somebody in a criminal case who has a long history of gang membership. Because everybody...
But you know, one of the problems with that realization is that I don't think people join gangs because I don't think people avoid joining gangs because of the hazards involved. I think they join gangs because of the hazard.
And the prestige, too.
Yeah, the mythology is that gangs are tough guys hanging together, and you do the crime, you do the time.
Well, they're doing the time.
And that kind of thinking And I think that's so lame and so anti-personnel kind of thinking that it bears some discussion. Maybe someday we get into the gang thing. But we've got Dave Atwood on the air. Dave, are you there?
I am here, Ray.
I am sorry to report that the witnesses have come and gone from the execution chamber in Huntsville, which means that tonight, just a few minutes ago, Mr. Moore, Frank Moore, was executed by the state of Texas before witnesses for some members of his family. His mother was at a demonstration outside of the walls, and you are where?
I am at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd. That's where we're having our execution vigils this month. And it's right out in front of the St. Anne's Church and a very busy corner, a lot of cars going by. So we've got about, I've had about eight people here tonight. It wasn't too bad. We have a woman from Germany that came over that visits prisoners on death row. She came to the vigil. And the rest were various Houston people. So, you know, I know you've probably had some discussion on this already, but I want to mention that we had this program last night with David. And
yeah, you're breaking up, so let me see if I can get some clarity. Yes, David Dow was doing a lecture last night. Where was that? Was that at St. Thomas?
That was at University of St. Thomas, and it's based on his book called Executed on a Technicality.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about this case today, about Moore's case, because he's been involved in it in terms of the, you know, trying to prevent the execution. And, you know, they have very strong evidence that this was a self-defense, and what happened, and he and again, you know, that he, even though he might have got a prison sentence, he certainly shouldn't have gone to death row because of the self-defense. That they had a witness come forth, witnessed this crime, and held back. It isn't anybody that knew Moore, but had witnessed this and held back coming forward all these years until he read about the execution schedule, and he held off because he had been involved in some criminal activity himself, and he just didn't want to come forth. And but I guess he sort of had straightened up his life, and he came forth and is credible at this point, a very credible witness. But they couldn't get this witness testimony before anybody that would stop the execution.
Dave, we basically covered these issues pretty thoroughly because there was a reversal in this case,
right?
On the principle of that those arguments were in the record, but apparently decided against by the jury, except that the jury did not have in the first trial the option of considering an alternative. So,
right.
So they got they had another trial. And perhaps his witnesses that you're talking about did not come forward until after that, but they
Right. It came. This witness came after the second trial, right?
Well, and you know, you and I have friends, Billy Hughes, among them, that after that second trial,
yeah,
it's a pretty slippery slope.
Oh yeah, right.
And opening up that can a third time is a very high burden, and you and I have been through that before. And there's no question about Texas' eagerness to execute.
Right.
Plays in a great many of these cases, and there just seems to be a thirst. And as I said on KPFT News prior to this broadcast, that the change in the composition of the Court of Criminal Appeals has a great deal to do with what happens to these cases.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I want to mention again Dow's book, because, you know, it's a an excellent book. I think it's available in the, if you go to one of the major bookstores, or probably on Amazon too. And you know, he part of his argument, David was the founder of the Texas Innocence Network, but when he talks, he doesn't always talk about pure innocence cases. He talks about so many of these people that are on death row, even though they did something. You know, they're guilty of something, certainly. But they couldn't get there because they didn't meet this criteria that we supposedly for somebody getting the death penalty. And that's what he goes into, and it's a very, very excellent book on the death penalty system in Texas in particular. And I want to just sort of push that book a little bit. David did a wonderful job talking about these things last night. He's a very good communicator. He's very hard to get on for interviews. He's very hard to get to talk because he's so busy. And he did a wonderful job for us last night, Ray. And
I'm sure. And Dave, I don't want you to get away without mentioning your book.
Yeah, Detour to Death Row, and that's more about. I do get into the criminal justice system a fair amount there, but of course I don't have the detail that David does and the experience he's had, 100 cases. But the Detour to Death Row is about my personal experience with the death penalty in Texas, and that book is available on Amazon. Anybody who wants to go to Amazon can find it, Detour to Death Row.
Okay, I want to thank David Atwood, who is at the Houston Vigil. He's with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And if you just jot down the first letters of those words, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, tcadp.org, that's the website, and you can get more information. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks for seeing you too.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
And that was Dave Atwood, and he was at the Houston Vigil at St. Anne's Church in the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd. If you want to participate in these vigils, you may do so. Anytime there's an execution, there will be a gathering at St. Anne's Church at the corner of Westheimer that this month, Westheimer and Shepherd. Or if you want to drive all the way to Huntsville, outside the death chamber, they call it the Walls. It's the oldest original unit of the Texas prison system. I've lived there for a short period of time in my transfer between various units back when I was a Texas convict. We're going to hunt up Scott Cobb, who is the president of Texas Moratorium Network. Scott has organized lobby days and conducted grassroots training workshop, drafted anti-death penalty legislation, and organized many protests against the death penalty. He's going to be with us in a few minutes. In the meantime, I am still here with Jim.
Let me mention one thing I need to kind of clarify something. I don't know exactly what witnesses they claimed they found after the second trial, but the things that were considered were not considered by state court. They were considered by federal courts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what had happened, this guy by the name of Warren Ewell, the investigator I mentioned earlier who had a private security company who did security for the public housing projects in San Antonio, he was apparently the major witness that came forward in the federal writ.
And apparently had a longer relationship with Moore.
Right. And he apparently had some long relationship with Moore. And I saw all the parties involved. He knew the two dead men, the two men who were shot. He knew most of the parties involved in it. And he was the one that gathered up all the evidence that claimed that there had been shooting from the car first. He was the one that claimed that he had witnesses that said that the family of the dead boys took the guns away from the murder scene before the police arrived. He claimed that there were bullet holes in the building behind Moore to prove that he'd been shot at first.
A lot of information for a man that wasn't there.
Well, he was supposedly, according to him, was the very first law enforcement officer on the scene. And he comes forward, and all this was considered not by state court. It was considered by the Western District. The writ was filed in the Western District of San Antonio in federal court, and they rejected it. And it went to the Fifth Circuit, and they rejected it. Again, and this is a real hard test to pass, whenever you're claiming that there's new evidence of showing innocence, you got to be able to demonstrate that this was something that was unavailable at time of trial and something you couldn't have found out with due diligence. And they said, well, in this case, Frank Moore always knew this guy. Frank Moore knew as much about Warren Hewell as anybody. And that he was very well aware of the fact that Warren Hewell existed. Apparently knew him. And they made no effort to use the testimony of Warren Hewell in the first trial or second trial.
What about cracking the shell the third time? What about the third trial, and how often does that happen?
I'm trying to think if there's ever been. I'm sure there has been a third trial.
I've got friends on death row that are hoping there will be one. Yeah.
It is really, really difficult. In fact, as a general rule, when they retry these cases, the state usually has a better shot at convicting you because in the first trial, they don't know what your defense is going to be.
Surprise.
And the second trial, they know, because they knew ahead of time in the second trial going around, they knew there was going to be testimony from Frank Moore's people that the two guys in the car tried to run over them. They knew that ahead of time. Yeah. So they were much better prepared on the second trial. And usually in a retrial, the state has a much better advantage because they already know what your defensive theory is going to be, and they can pretty well wire around you. Usually the second trial is death. I mean,
unless,
really,
as in the case of E. Roy Brown, the state had gummed up the trial the first time round, and you've got that record.
Right, and then you'll have occasionally where the second trial is a lot easier when you may have a witness that wasn't as good as it was to begin with, and you got embarrassed, and you can straighten that up on the second trial. But as a general rule, the second trial is favor of the state.
The E. Roy Brown case, incidentally, was a convict killed the warden and the farm supervisor, the field major. And that field major was my first cousin. And I was on the defense team in E. Roy's trial, and we convinced 35 out of 36 jurors in three trials that E. Roy was not guilty. Normally, convict kills a warden and a high-ranking prison official. That case can't be won in Texas.
I wouldn't think so.
But
I went to Galveston County, and that helped a whole lot.
Yeah, Bill Haber. Yeah, he got to Galveston County. The sheriff even put the telephone and said, why don't you call Ray Hill on the prison show while you're down here?
I'm not sure many counties. I'm trying to think. Galveston County is about the only county I can
think of. Well, we went to Edinburgh after Galveston. We tried it twice in Galveston, then tried it down in Edinburgh. We did pretty well in Edinburgh.
Edinburgh will understand it a little bit.
Edinburgh makes
they have kind of a different attitude along the border. You got to get close to the border and the ocean. People in Texas get more sense, I think.
And you may be made uncomfortable with the fact that once in a while during these programs, Jim and I will get together and start laughing because it seems an unusual thing to do on the occasion of someone being executed. But executions happen so frequently in Texas that this is everyday business down here. And life will of necessity go on. Well, I've just been informed by our fine producer that Scott Cobb cannot be found and is not going to join us on the show. So that means we've got about 15 minutes here to talk about. And what I'd like to do with this 15 minutes, if Jim feels adaptable and malleable, why don't we talk about gangs?
Good. You know, I was reading, I wish I'd have read more articles about it. I was reading a big article in the Houston Press about the way the courts in Phoenix in Arizona were treating their juveniles. And I was just somewhat floored because it's certifying so many of these kids over to adult court. I'm talking about kids 14 and 15 years of age.
Well, they've done enough of that in Harris County.
And they certify these kids over. And what's really tragic, to give you an idea about the gang stuff and the juvenile stuff, the last time I went to death row was a number of years ago. I was shocked at the number of people on death row who literally were raised by our institutions. They started out in reform school, generally as runaways, mm-hmm. kids that were problems. Ended up in reform school, the way they got treated through this reform school system. And that's when a lot of them get introduced to gangs there. It's where it all begins. And I can kind of understand, you know, if you're especially kicked around, abused a lot, how you'd be attracted to a gang. It's a rebellion sort of thing. It gives you some identity, gives you some protection. You've got a big brother looking over you.
Well, you know, my experience may be a little different from the popular mythology. Mm-hmm. I remember interviewing Butch Ainsworth, who the Ruiz case said was the meanest man in Texas prison. And Butch was what they called a building tender, which meant he was an inmate who the officials...
Didn't Texas Monthly have him on a cover
sometime? Oh, yeah.
I was thinking that.
Yeah, meanest man in Texas. That's a Texas Monthly one-game title.
Well, that was that guy that had, all those tattoos and they're
right.
The building tenders, wasn't
it? Yeah, he was a building tender guy. And, and no question about it, Butch was a mean dude. No question about it. But he was in Harris County Jail and waiting return to prison after he'd gotten out and married some preacher's daughter. And he and her had a fight because she didn't know how women's supposed to act for convict tough guys. And went and had a fight with her preacher father and blew him in half with a shotgun. And so that was the end of that that romance, and back to prison Butch went. And he told me from jail, he said, you know, I believe that I'm going to learn to write this time. He'd been locked up since the old Texas Youth Commission prisons, the teenage prisons that Willie Wayne Justice broke up many, many years ago. And he said, because they got these computers down here, it makes it easy to learn to read and write. And I think I'll learn to read and write this time. By this time, he was 40.
My gosh.
And he had never learned to read and write. And he had had an enormous amount of power in prison. And he referred to the building tenders as the approved gang. He said, we were all in the same gang back in juvenile prison before that broke up. And then when we got to adult prisons, the gang continued and the prison system gave us authority over everybody else and made us building tenders. So the system itself actually is exploits this gang theory. And there was a young fellow who worked for the Houston Police Department at one point. He just got elected to be your high sheriff in Harris County, and that's when I met him, is when he was in HPD. He was in the gang task force, and he called me and said, Mr. Hill, I don't believe we're doing this right. And I said, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, we're going around telling youngsters in gangs that the police is a gang, too.
Well, it is a gang, isn't it?
But we carry guns and badges, and we are a sanctioned gang, and you're not a sanctioned gang, and we're tougher than you are, and we can win. and that only reinforced the theory that gangs are tough guys hanging together. And I think it's probably more accurate to describe gangs, organized gangs, as weak people being manipulated by cowards, because the guy at the top are not running the risk. It's the rank and file. Now, where the hell would I get an idea like that? My great attempt in journalism was a story about motorcycle gangs when I was covering the Bandidos and the Hells Angels. And so I went out to California, interviewed Sonny Borger.
Okay, I mean, Hells Angel guy,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And while I was interviewing Sonny, this kid came in, and he had just been given a contract to kill an important public official, whose name escapes me at the time. Didn't happen anyway. But he said, thank you, Mr. Borger. Thank you. Breathing heavy, and he's so appreciative for that. And Sonny, when he left, I said, Sonny, why is that kid so full of gratitude? I mean, you know, if he does that, he's going to get busted. And Sonny said, he's weak. And I said, well, why don't you do it? And he said, I'm not going to put myself at that kind of jeopardy. In journalism talk, that is a coward manipulating weak people. And that's what I find gangs to be. But we have found Scott Kopp. Scott, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. How you doing, Ray?
Welcome to Execution Watch here on KPFT HD2 channel. Apparently, Texas has just got through executing Frank Moore. And we talked to his mother and some of the witnesses at demonstrations in Houston and Huntsville. I've been talking about the legal elements of the case and the story with Jim Skelton here. You are the president of Texas Moratorium Network.
Yes, that's correct.
And are you familiar at all with this case?
Well, I'm not real familiar with this case. I was hoping I could talk to you about what we're planning for the upcoming legislative.
Well, please do that, because legislature's cooking right now, isn't it?
Yeah, they just started up, I think, on the 13th or 12th. And so it's kind of a low period right now, but they'll be having committee hearings starting in February, and we're going to be interested in several bills that are going to be coming up. Most prominently, a new bill that hasn't been filed before has to do, grew out of the Kenneth Foster case, has to do with the law of parties, and it's been filed by Representative Dutton there in Houston, and it would make people no longer convicted under the law of parties eligible for the death penalty, at least in the future. In the past cases, it wouldn't be retroactive, but it would certainly be a major issue for lawyers to bring up.
But it doesn't eliminate the culpability under law of parties concept, does it?
It doesn't limit the culpability. It just removes the eligibility for the death penalty.
Okay.
And I think there are a lot of people in Texas uses it to make people eligible for the death penalty much, much more frequently than in other states. Kenneth Foster is the most famous case of the last couple of years. There was also Jeff Wood, who got a stay on another issue, but he could be coming up again if they resolve that issue about mental illness. Hopefully he'll be permanently removed from death row, but he's also a law of parties case. And so I think there's going to be a good reception at the Capitol regarding the law of parties issue. Hasn't been considered before. You may not know, or your listeners may not know, but since 2003 there's been a gradual decline in the number of Republicans in the House.
Mm-hmm.
The House. So right now it went from 88-62 in 2002. Or 2003 to today, 76-74.
And you have a new speaker.
We have a new speaker, and that's going to mean he's a moderate. He was elected with mostly 11 Republicans and 64 Democrats, so I think he's going to be certainly a lot more sympathetic towards reform issues than his predecessor.
Who are your committee chairs in both the House and the Senate?
They haven't yet appointed the committee chairs. Hopefully they're going to be a new chair in the House, but it's not for sure. There could be still the same one from last time, Aaron Pena. He's the one who killed the Innocence Commission last session, so I understand he's now on board with the Innocence Commission, more or less, but we would...
Looking for friends, you would say.
What's that?
He's looking for friends, you might say.
That's, Aaron Pena got on board at the last minute with the new speaker, so he could remain as chair, but I hope not. See what happens in the next couple of weeks.
Well, you know, I have, to give you some idea how long I've been over there, since Alan Place was chair of that committee, and that's been a long time ago from Gatesville. But Alan is sort of...
I remember the last time there was a Democratic chair was 2001, and that was the year that they passed the Fair Defense Act and
mm-hmm.
other important stuff. So, you know, it does play a big role when you have a sympathetic chair. So we'll see what happens.
And in the Senate?
There's one other issue that we're working with, and that is to try to get someone to file a bill to impeach Sharon Keller.
The 5 o'clock judge at Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
Right. We closed at 5, and she wouldn't take the appeal from the lawyers who are having computer problems and wanted to submit it 15 minutes afterwards.
And I always add when I tell that story that it was a certain stay. If she had accepted the paperwork because of actions...
Absolute certain stay. And the fact that she did not rule on it, I mean, she could have accepted it and declined.
And there were other judges...
Given the U.S. Supreme Court the authority to stay the execution, but the U.S. Supreme Court said that they could not rule, give a stay, because there was no final adjudication at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
So she just gummed up the whole works.
Really, she absolutely did, and... And what came out later by R.G. Ratcliffe in the Houston Chronicle, he did a public information request asking what the rules in effect, what were the rules in effect on the day of that execution. And she wrote him back saying that there were rules in effect. They were not written down, but they were still rules in effect that day. And since then, we have now written them down. And those rules clearly state that what she did was a violation of the rules by not... giving the case to the assigned duty judge that night. But we think this is certainly grounds for removal, and we have one legislator who's already expressed interest in doing it. He's researching it, so I think we might be able to get some progress on that issue. She's not up for election until 2012, so it'll be good to get her out of there. And it only takes a simple majority in the House to impeach Cohen, such as the judge. Two-thirds
really?
Convict in the Senate. But if she is impeached in the House, she would be automatically suspended from duty. So that's good.
Really, but it takes simple majority to impeach, but it takes two-thirds of the Senate to convict, and that's 25 votes.
Right.
Now, the structure in the Senate is a little different from the House.
What's that?
The structure in the Senate is a little different from the House.
The Senate, you know, they require two-thirds majority to take up issues, and so things go a little slower there. I have noticed that they did generally take a more... a larger view of what's good for the state, so something that might pass in the Senate might get bogged down on more partisan issues in the House. So, you know, they have a different structure, but you can work with that.
Well, are you optimistic at all about your work?
Yes, I'm very optimistic with this new change in the House, new Speaker, and just in general, I think the political environment is a little bit less partisan these days, what with the election of President Obama, even though we work at the state level. I think it carries over in a sense of hopeful change, and I think that could help us as we push for issues like the law of parties or the Innocence Commission, a moratorium on executions, or a study commission. You know, that study commissions that have been set up in other states have come to the conclusion, often, certainly in New Jersey, that they should abolish the death penalty. Even the one in Illinois back in 2000, they had an informal vote. It wasn't an official vote, but it was informal that they were in favor of abolishing the death penalty in Illinois. That wasn't their final recommendation. But when you do have these study commissions, they can make some recommendations that you don't necessarily accept.
Yes, I was billed in Santa Barbara at UC Santa Barbara with one of the chairs of that commission contemporaneously to its work. And they stopped short of recommending commuting those sentences, but the governor went ahead and did it on his own nickel.
That's what happens when you have somebody in the governor's office who can... decent person. We don't have that right now.
Can ride the heat on it. If folks are coming to Austin, how can they help your work? How do they get in touch with you at the Texas Coalition, Texas Moratorium Network? How does that happen?
Well, they can go to our website, texasmoratorium.org, and we just changed our phone number, so I can't remember it right now. But get in touch with us, and we are planning to have some sort of lobby day in the last week of March when it's tentatively scheduled. So we want to get as many people here for that. We've been doing this since 2000, I guess the first one, 2003. And, you know, we come up here early in the day and talk about how to communicate your ideas to legislators, go over the bills, and then in the afternoon we'll visit legislative offices, and if there's a committee hearing, we'll testify. And we're planning a big rally around 5:30.
And that date again is?
We haven't set the
exact date
to appoint the committee. Probably going to be the last week in March, though. That's what we're looking at.
Scott, I've got to run because we've got to take this show and put it on the road. But please keep, we at KPFT's The Prison Show and at Execution Watch. .org informed, and we will dutifully pass that information on to our website viewers and our listeners.
All right. Well, I appreciate the invitation to come on and talk to you today.
And when I come over to Austin, we'll try to coffee up.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Scott Cobb. He is with the Texas Moratorium Network, and that is a Huntsville organization. I'm sure they are listed. He said their website was texasmoratorium.org, texasmoratorium.org. Jim, any closing words? We're rapidly running out of time here.
The only thing I would say that probably what they're talking about is not doing away with the law of parties, but not executing non-trigger man. I think law may be inartful the way they say it.
Yeah.
And that the big controversy, should you be able to execute a non-trigger person? The law of parties really is kind of over-exaggerated.
And certainly those reforms, as long as you didn't remove final culpability and,
right.
and let Charles Manson off the hook, Jim looked like he'd be smiling.
Right.
My name is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch. You're listening to it on executionwatch.org and on KPFT HD2 channel. I want to recognize the fine work of our producer, Elizabeth Ann Stein. She can be reached at her email address, stein@yahoo.com. And you can also, we've got to express our deep appreciation to Otis McClay. Without his wizardry, we would not be in this business. And Otis can be reached here at the radio station by various means. And thank you, Jim Skelton.
You're welcome. Enjoy.
And it's good to be here. And unfortunately, we'll be back tomorrow night.
Got you. See you tomorrow.
Thank you, folks, and good night.